This is Regionally Speaking here on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. The nearly four-year-long Surgical Services Department project at Community Hospital in Munster is nearly complete. It's part of the overall $40 million investment at the hospital, which began 5 years ago. It includes the new emergency department pavilion. I sat down in the conference room at the hospital this morning to talk with Dr. Richard Berkowitz, who is the medical director of surgical services, and John Olmsted, who is a registered nurse and also the director of surgical services at Community Hospital. And I asked them both about the planning that went into this project as well as the improvements. Dr. Berkowitz, how did things get to the point with this new surgical center that it's become a part of the overall $40 million investment that the community hospital has put in here over the last 5 years to make the Munster operation more effective and more modern?
Well, the segue for the surgical department or the perioperative services department for us was the initial building of the Parkview Tower, which houses a lot of the mother-baby medical care along with some other telemetry units. And so what that allowed us to do was to move into space previously occupied by them that made the entire perioperative service area better for both patients and the surgeons who operate here.
Okay. Mr. Olmsted, when you take a look at the overall operation, what in particular stands out to you, to, of course, your colleagues, the doctors and nurses and the other staff here at Community Hospital, that in turn will make it possibly more interesting, maybe more attractive to other doctors outside of the system, as well as to patients or potential patients?
If I had to summarize over the past several years, what are the real focus of our hospital is just to more embrace becoming an acute care hospital. We've always been deeply involved in acute care surgery, acute care services, and this expansion just adds to that. So we were able to build this new patient tower, expand a nursery, which Dr. Berkowitz can talk about because that certainly is in his field, and our labor and delivery areas to expand services there. But also, opening up that space allowed us to expand our surgical department to, again, increase all the acute care surgery that we do here at Community Hospital. It's funny, when it comes to surgery, minor surgery is what happens to the other guy. So not to minimize any surgery, but certainly we do. There's really not a whole lot we don't do here at Community except for transplants. We do a lot of cardiac surgery, a lot of spine surgery, a lot of neurosurgery, general surgery. And this just allows us more space and technology to continue that mission.
I was thinking that probably that the upgrades that have been made here at Community Hospital kind of lead on to the fact that you can do more surgery, that maybe you think maybe someday, if things go well, that maybe that the transplants might not be out of the reach for the hospital, especially with all of the new improvements and developments that have happened for the surgical center here.
I think that not knowing what the future of medicine holds, I think that there are so many factors involved in trying to do transplant medicine that a lot of times that type of surgery is left better to the university programs where they truly are able to establish a multidisciplinary approach to the specifics.
But you're able to do some more things, I'm sure, now with the new facility here at the hospital that even before that you could do, and probably you feel more comfortable and more confident that you can do a better job, I would imagine.
Right. One of the programs, the most recent program we started was minimally invasive valve surgery that we collaborated with the cardiologists and the surgeons and nursing to be able to offer patients the ability to get valves replaced without having to go through a major 4 to 5 hour surgical operation.
Take us through the new and improved surgical center that's going to be finished up here in the end of April for not only doctors and staff here at the hospital, but the patients can experience as well. To tell us about what the facility is going to be like or is like, even now as the sections that are open, and what people coming into the hospital can expect.
So one of the issues that we were faced with initially was patient flow. Okay, so our patients would start out, our same day as surgical patients would start out in another part of the hospital, not adjacent to the operating rooms. And so what we were able to do when the mother-baby medical care moved to the other tower was establish our same day surgical admission unit on the same floor, just adjacent to the operating rooms. And so it allows for the patients to get admitted to very nice rooms in the morning. okay, where they wait for their surgeon, their anesthesiologist, they get admitted for their surgical care, and then that flow is all on the same floor. They don't have to be taken. They go right from that room into the operating room. They no longer have to be transported to a holding room and then into the surgical area. So the patients and the families like that approach much much better than they did the old approach, which was having to be, I think it was John, they were moved almost two blocks from, you know, when you really calculate the distance.
It seemed like way. I imagine it doesn't matter. It could have been across the city for all you know.
So it was really inconvenient, I think, and now it's a much better experience for them. We've constructed new operating rooms, so we made four additional operating rooms during this construction process. We established the what we call the hybrid OR, which I alluded to earlier with our valve program, minimally invasive valve replacement program. The TAVR program, and then we are now starting to do some more construction in rehabbing some old operating rooms because these operating rooms were created, some of them in the early 70s, and we just need to refurbish them with modern technology as well as just refurbish them in general.
Okay. Since you've talked about what the convenience will be and probably comfort, psychological if not physical comfort for the patients too, that they won't have to. They have this even flow from coming into the door, so to speak, to going into the emergency or going into the operating room. They will be able to feel better. I'm sure they'll probably maybe recover a little better. A lot of stress, I suppose, on them too. What do the family members seem to feel about the new facilities, or what they will feel when everything is all up and running, so to speak?
I can tell you, there's two aspects to that. One, it's always nice to have a new area. And, you know, here at Community, when they rebuild things here, I mean, it looks amazing. I mean, it's just beautiful. But that pales in comparison to some of these new surgeries that we're able to do. Again, what Dr. Berkowitz is talking about, we're talking about a length of stay in a very invasive surgery that many of these patients weren't even a candidate for because they're so acutely ill, and now they're leaving the next day. I mean, it is unbelievable what we were able to do now. And it's just, we have some of the best doctors in the world here. It's just so exciting. And that coupled with our anesthesia professionals just makes such a magnificent experience. So, yes, it's nice to have newly painted walls and new carpet. But honestly, it's the service that is really making the difference. And when we talk about new construction, it's just not making a nifty new room. These are much larger rooms, which really great technology to help and enhance communications and visualization where you can just see things. If you speak to surgeons, they'll tell you they can just see things they were not able to see before and operate at a level of a specificity that is just very exciting. And so to see some of these enhancements here in the community that, no, you don't have to go to Mayo Clinic. No, you don't have to go to another state or even up to the city. We can do it right here and do it very, very well.
One of the things I've asked some of the other, even CEOs of the other healthcare systems in the past about, and I always like to check back with them on these things, is talking about the status of healthcare in Northwest Indiana. A lot of the conversation early on talked about the fact that the hospitals and clinics and other facilities here in Northwest Indiana have to compete with Chicago. You kind of mentioned that too about the fact, and we see, and not only that, we see now too that even operations like Rush have set up at least to some nearby facilities. In fact, I think maybe here in Munster, even there's a facility. They're looking to be able to, I think, to maybe not expand as much as serve the people that maybe have come in for procedures in Chicago, and maybe to be taken care of closer to home because they're from here instead of having to drive all the way into the medical district in Chicago. Do you think that facilities like what's been set up here and the improvements here at the community hospital will, if not take away the need for having to, you mentioned about having to go out of town, but it's going to make it a lot easier for everybody?
I think it truly, you know, that's our purpose. I think we provide the quality of care where people can feel comfortable coming here and knowing that they get that, what people refer to as the, I'll use the air quotes, you know, that Chicago-type major medical center care. And I can tell you from the perspective that I was in academic practice for 12 years prior to coming here in 1999. Mm-hmm. And I can tell you now with great certainty that we provide the same, if not better, quality care here at our hospital and our medical care system, our medical system, than can be provided in Chicago. Okay. So there's really no reason for patients to go to the city unless we really they require specialty care such as transplantation services and things like that.
Okay. Do you think that with the improvements that are here at Community Hospital, that this maybe, at least from your point of view, gentlemen, that you feel that kind of sets the hospital up better when we have situations developing like the ongoing look into the merger of Methodist hospitals with the Franciscan Alliance? It's all business, I know, but they do it for a reason, too, I suppose, that they want to be able to take care of their patients. Do you think that this maybe will put Community Hospital and maybe on a little, maybe not necessarily a step ahead, but certainly a little higher up on the list, you think?
Honestly, I leave that business to the CEOs. What we do is this is just a continuation of our mission. Mm-hmm. And in the end, that's what it's about. If you're a mission-oriented organization, you're going to be successful. And that's what's so exciting. We have a partnership here that Dr. Berkowitz and I sort of encapsulate Community Hospital in that it takes both. It takes a very astute physicians and hardworking nursing staff and support staff. And so I'm a nursing director, and I coordinate a lot of that staff, and Dr. Berkowitz is a physician leader. And it really takes both of us to coordinate this kind of care. And that's really what Community Hospital does. And so with other organizations, I wish them success, but really we're just focused on today and taking care of the patients that come in. And like I said, it's just exciting to see some physicians that have been practicing for 20-some years who are so invigorated and so excited about the future. They're not just doing the way things they've always done it. They're very excited about the new research and new procedures coming out. So it's really exciting to be a part of it.
It probably helps the younger physicians, the ones that have maybe just come out of medical school off residency. They're actually getting to be full-fledged physicians. They probably have learned a lot of these newer techniques that you're offering here at the Community Hospital. And they probably feel, they come in, they probably feel much more at home. They probably feel also invigorated, as well as the veteran physicians too, I would imagine.
Yeah, I just want to point for a second to what John said, and we have an example. We had a vendor who we've used in our operating rooms, and the vendor had just come back from the Mayo Clinic, and his comment to me was, after seeing our new operating facility, he said, "You know what? Mayo Clinic has nothing on you guys as far as the facilities."
Just to set a wonderful compliment,
right? It was really good to hear because a lot of people have invested a lot of time and effort and obviously money into making this, a top-notch medical center. And I think part of it too is being able to approach our administration, approach the board, and say, you know, this is the vision that we have, and it's sort of they've inspired a shared vision with the entire system, and I think that that's what's really important.
Now, I don't know if there's going to be an official ribbon cutting, so to speak, for the facilities here. You're probably getting to use some of the facilities even as we speak today here, as things have opened up and the operating rooms are ready to be used. You probably are keeping them busy even now. How do things look on this little timetable ahead to finish things up towards the end of the month, as what has already been said will happen?
Yeah, I think any time that you deal with old construction and you're remodeling, you always find little glitches along the way. But we've pretty much, John had set out a timeline from the beginning, and we're pretty darn near keeping with that timeline. We've had to make some changes along the way as far as how we're going to approach reconstruction. But I think by the fall of this year, we should be pretty much complete with the entire project.
You feel more comfortable, and you know that you're ready to have all of this difficult part. It's not easy to try to deal with the construction and still keep a hospital in operation at the same time. But you're able to look ahead and move right into the new era, so to speak.
And I think that's where John has done a great job with the nursing staff. We never use the construction as an excuse not to be able to do surgical cases. Mm-hmm. And the staff has picked up on that, and I can tell you, we have received very few complaints from any of the surgeons or patients, anything about the fact that there's been delays in surgery or anything like that. So we're very proud of that fact, and John and his staff needs to be proud of what they've been able to accomplish.
That's Dr. Richard Berkowitz, who's the medical director for surgery here at Community Hospital, along with John Olmstead, who is the director of surgical services for Community Hospital. Thank you both for being with us today.
Thank you.
Indiana Arts Commission has just put out its 5-year strategic plan. And to find out more, let's talk to Louis Rickey, who is the executive director of the IAC. He's at his office in Indianapolis, and we're speaking with him there. Louis, thanks for being with us here on Regionally Speaking today.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Tell us about the work that has gone into coming up with this five-year strategic plan, and what is that going to mean for arts organizations all across Indiana, including here in Northwest Indiana?
The strategic planning process took us a bit more than a year to execute, and it started by doing some research where we surveyed individual artists, arts organizations, community members, and we had, you know, quite a really good response with about 3,000 responses to our various surveys across the state. That gave us sort of a baseline or a white paper type of thing for a steering committee to start looking at. We assembled a steering committee made up of people from across the state that is representative culturally, geographically, and different types of organizations, potential grantees, individual artists, all sorts of folks. We had about a 25-member steering committee, and these are people from higher education, from civic life, philanthropy, all sorts of things. We also did public forums, and we did these were sort of like focus groups that we did live, but we also did them online. So you could participate either by going to a locale around the state, or you could actually be online and be part of it as well. We did one focused on individual artists, one focused on organizations, and one focused on communities, and anyone could join these. So this information then was taken and looked at by the steering committee, and the plan was formulated by them reviewing that information as we amassed it, and then it would go back to the commission for review, and then back out to the committee, which was completely external people to the commission. Yeah, we also had professional facilitation. Sarah Peterson, who's a great facilitator from Bloomington, donated her services to facilitate the plan.
I think people probably don't realize how many people here in Indiana are involved in some way or another with the arts. I know that the IAC had gotten, I guess, the very first statewide research study came back earlier this year, and it had some surprising facts in there. Tell us about what you discovered and as to how big the arts organization scene in Indiana really is.
If you're referring to, we did an employment study for the state of Indiana, which we looked at the creative industries, the creative economy across our state. So the creative economy is comprised of institutions that have a creative purpose, be they for-profit or not-for-profit. So this could be a gallery or a museum or a symphony or a theater, that sort of thing. And then there's also employment in non-creative industries. And an example of this might be, a designer that would work for Cummins Engine Company would also be a creative employee in our state. So if you look at the entire creative economy, so that's creative people that work inside creative institutions, non-creative people that work inside of creative institutions, like an accountant that works at a theater, and then creative folks that work in other industries, there are about 160,000 jobs in the state of Indiana. So that's a pretty large workforce that's part of the creative economy of our state. If you take a look at what that compares to, that's about the same size as the city of Evansville.
Wow.
We have a creative economy in our state. So it's a fairly large amount of people.
Now, we know it's not likely to happen, but wouldn't it be great to have an entire community, you say, concentrated in the arts? And I suppose there are probably a lot of communities that feel that they have a good concentration of the arts already. It's nice to know that so many people in Indiana are involved in one way or the other in creative jobs like that. By the way, you can take a look at this five-year strategic plan on the Indiana Arts Commission website. And I took a peek earlier before our conversation, and Lewis, I came up, if I counted right, with their four main groups that are set up in this plan. Will you tell us what those are, please?
Well, if you're talking about, we're looking at individual artists around the state, arts organizations around the state communities. So these would be community leadership from around the state, and then patrons, people who are involved in the arts as attendees and trustees and that sort of thing. So these are the major groups, the major constituents, I suppose, that both had input into the plan and are affected directly by the plan.
Now, what are you hoping over the next 5 years that the Indiana Arts Commission can do to cover all of these areas, not only communities, but organizations and the like, to help them grow?
Well, the real central tenet of the plan is helping the arts become more central to the lives of people and to community life in our state. So the concept that a theater or an orchestra or any artistic endeavor is somehow off to the side of the rest of community life and somehow independent of it is something that a notion which is very much changing in the way the arts are in our state and in America. So this whole concept of the arts and something else, the arts being applied to other types of community solutions and community problems and community efforts and community focal points is really a concept that's coming into its own. And so the idea is that we migrate arts center of community life, and then it affects really all of community life in a positive way. So you not only get the benefit of the artistic product itself, but you get the benefit of it being applied as well to bigger community needs, challenges, aspirations, those kind of things.
I imagine even though it isn't directly related, it is in many parts related to economic development in a community. We've talked here just briefly about this employment study that was done, and you come up with more than 160,000 Hoosiers are involved in some kind of arts or arts-related jobs across the Hoosier state. And I'm sure that, of course, means something for at least a locality's economy, too, doesn't it?
Well, absolutely. I mean, I think the arts are effective in economic development in two major ways. First of all, the arts provide a creative backdrop for all industry in the state. Obviously, for a business to be located in Indiana and to attract employees want a certain quality of life. They want to raise their families and have the assets culturally that are enjoyable to them. So it produces a backdrop for all of economic development. And then, as we're talking about specifically employment within the arts, it also is an employment base in itself. The creative industries are an employment base in themselves. So it really affects and benefits economic development in two major ways.
Now, I'm sure this is not included in the 5-year strategic plan because you can't probably work on such a short notice on some of these things, and you had all this input before you coming up with this plan. But I'm sure that you and others at the Indiana Arts Commission are keeping a very close eye on what is happening nationally with the threats to federal funding that in turn affect the arts, like the National Endowment for the Arts and other organizations that are related to. What does the IAC try to do to be sure to encourage patrons and organizations to keep pushing hard to let their Congress members know, and even the White House know, that it's very important to keep this funding going?
Made a good point. It's important for citizens to let decision makers know about the mm-hmm. public value of the arts. And, the public value of the arts, federal money, be it from the National Endowment for the Arts and state money from the Arts Commission, from our legislature, it serves some really important purposes in the whole ecosystem of the arts in America. So it's first and foremost, the process that we put organizations and artists through in order to access public monies is really rigorous. So it establishes some baseline accountability for arts organizations to return value to citizens. And that is then scaffolded on by other types of philanthropy and support. So I'm doubtful that there would be any foundation out there that would seriously consider a gift to an organization that hasn't gone through our process and is getting public funds. So it creates a level of accountability and quality for the arts in America. Also, we open up with public dollars things that are more closely held to be of wide public value for people to be accessible. So, for instance, you know, our money may not pay for the 8 o'clock concert of a symphony, but it helps to bring that symphony maybe into a school or a community center mm-hmm. to open up something to a wider thing. And finally, it assures that there's some educational value, some enduring value for the arts after the arts experience is over. Those are three major things that public funding does that other kinds of funding don't necessarily do. And it's important for people to let their decision makers know that this is an important function of public money and that it's valued by them.
We've been talking with Lewis Ricci, who's the executive director of the Indiana Arts Commission, mainly talking about the new five-year strategic plan that the IAC has in place. You can take a look at it in more detail, if you like, on the Indiana Arts Commission website, and finding out, too, about the push to make sure that lawmakers know that any of the funding on the federal level or even the state level for the arts is not expendable. It's very important to have it in place there. Lewis, thank you very much for being with us to talk about these topics. We appreciate it, and we're looking forward to finding out more about IAC activities and the activities that support the arts all across Indiana, including here in Northwest Indiana. Thank you for being with us today.
Thank you.
This is Financial Literacy Month. It's a time that's dedicated to highlighting the importance of financial literacy in the hopes that Americans will set up and maintain some very healthy financial habits. And we have to talk about it. Northwest Indiana financial advisor Greg Happer with us once again. And I guess this is a good time for Northwest Indiana residents to take a look at their own real serious financial literacy, isn't it, Greg? And I guess some of us need some help. And there have been some studies that have been out that say that only, 37% of Americans could pass any kind of basic financial knowledge test. Well, what can we do to improve that record and be prepared for whatever comes about us financially?
Well, I think the big opportunity, Chris, is people just becoming more aware of what opportunities are out there and some of the things that they're doing currently. And that's what's nice just about having the Awareness Month is it kind of draws your attention to the things that go by and by, you know, by the wayside every day because of our normal routine. So just focusing on some of the things you're doing to strategize to begin, you know, saving or getting out of debt are things that are going to benefit you.
In fact, I noticed that's one of the things here that I have noted down here that's of points that we probably should talk about is getting out of debt. Tell us what's the wise thing to do on that.
Well, I think it's going to be more of a prominent focus now because interest rates, what everybody's telling us, right, is they're going to start rising. Mm-hmm. So a lot of these debt positions have been set on a variable rate, which have been in historic lows. And as this interest rates start to climb, it's going to, you know, it's going to cost more for that leveraged debt. And it's always hard to focus on saving when you have those high interest debts that are going to start, you know, I guess, cutting into the whatever results you're getting on the positive side from an investment strategy. So debt's always got to be a focus to get out of.
And we should probably think ahead in case something happens. We don't always plan for emergencies, but it's probably a pretty good idea, eh?
Yeah, usually before we even recommend somebody start saving a program is build up a cash reserves at least 3 to 6 months because if you don't, you know, I always tell them life happens. You know, things are still going to go wrong. Expenses are still going to come up. And if you don't have that emergency reserve, one of two things. You're either going to go back into debt or you're going to pull out of the investment strategies, which, you know, and then the timing, it might not be a good situation to pull it out that particular moment and it could cause you more problems.
Probably not a bad idea to have just a regular savings account, would it? Wouldn't have to necessarily be a real serious interest-bearing one, but just have something there to store that reserve in, huh?
Yeah, absolutely. It's not about making money. It's about being there to avoid the problems that you would have if you didn't have the cash reserves.
Let's take a look at capturing the future here. What are some of the interesting points we should note here about, and we've talked about some of these before, I know, in past conversations, about taking care of your money besides looking to the emergency situation?
Yeah, well, I mean, the future, you have to take control of the things that you're doing currently because there's a lot of the companies are shifting away from defined benefits. There's very few pensions anymore. And if you don't begin paying yourself now, paying yourself first, as we like to phrase it, it's going to be more difficult to save after you go through and you're nearing retirement when the time horizon isn't going to be on your side because markets, for the most part, they're going to do what they're going to do. They're going to go up. They're going to go down. But if we have longer time horizons, generally the results are a lot more predictable. And you basically need to focus on, you know, what you're going to contribute, because just planning on Social Security for most families is not going to be enough.
Mm-hmm. We talked in the past year about the importance of individual retirement accounts, and we know that certainly the older you get, you have the opportunity, and many of them, to be able to put even more money in up to the limit, don't you?
Yep, and they got a lot of catch-up provisions right now. The 401ks are the first thing we always have a conversation with. If your company has a 401k, and specifically if they're going to match, you definitely want to take advantage of the match dollars. But one of the nice things about having a structured plan like that, I'm no different. You know, if I don't see the money, there's no way I'm going to spend it. So having that, it creates that discipline to pay yourself first. It comes out automatically from your paycheck, and that's something that you can gradually increase over time to work towards amounts that are going to be beneficial for you. You know, you can do it in $5, $10, $15 a pay period, and over time it allows you to increase your savings substantially.
You probably should also, too, take care and make sure that maybe if you are involved, for example, in a mutual fund of some sort to try to diversify your portfolio, that might be wise to even look ways to diversify even further, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, a lot of people hear diversifying and diversification, what does it mean? Yeah, you diversify within your portfolios, but sometimes the types of investments that are not necessarily correlated directly to the market can be a great way to diversify your money as well.
Now, speaking about money, protecting it's very important, I know, too. What are some things that we probably should do, Greg, that would be wise moves, either certainly individually or as a family, and certainly with the help of a financial advisor?
Well, one of the things that I always like to make my clients aware of is the tax implications in terms of contributions to a qualified plan versus something like a Roth IRA that doesn't necessarily give you the deduction, and take a look at the value added now versus later. So reducing the amount of taxes can definitely increase the dollars that are working for you, but then also on the distribution side of it, considering what taxes what kind of impact it would have when you retire. But then also, as most people are aware, there's a huge awareness in the industry right now, especially with some of the things that are going on with the Department of Labor and the law changes. You know, just understanding the fees that you have and understanding what those fees are, what value they're bringing to either you from a planning aspect or to your portfolio, and make sure the fees are justified. You know, if the fees can be reduced, always be cognitive of less fees. But if you are paying fees, make sure that the value is there in other planning aspects.
We're talking with Northwest Indiana financial advisor Greg Hammer during this Financial Literacy Month. And I know that we've talked about making wise decisions on investments and protecting your investments and protecting your money flow. And it's something probably, too, we should do something, if we haven't done so already, to help protect our family. And that's we hate to think about some of these things, but there'll be a time that we're not there and they need the help. Tell us what we should be doing now to be able to protect our family.
Well, there's a couple things, and it's never too young to start. I mean, this is one of the things I do myself. You know, I don't just preach it, but when you go into a simple power of attorney from even a medical standpoint, if something were to happen, but even establishing, you know, limited power of attorneys as you get into an age where you might need help from a child or another family member, or if you don't have a family member, it's even more critical. You know, to help them in the times when decisions may become a little bit more difficult for that individual. And it makes it easier on the kids. You know, if you state your desired wishes, exactly what it is that you want to do in a way of a will or any, put it in writing, you know, it helps the kids with the struggles after, you know, mom and dad can't handle it. You know, more than one child's probably never going to agree on what's the best for mom and dad 100%. So if you can clearly state it, it's going to make it a lot easier on those children.
I know that in case of having a will, it's very important. My wife and I have one to take care of our daughter in the future, if need be. I know of, unfortunately, of family members and in-laws that didn't have wills, and they're dealing with matters now involving in the court system. Luckily, it's not been very painful, but it can be. It can be pretty nasty if you don't plan ahead like that, isn't it?
Absolutely. And, you know, the laws have changed so much. There used to be a large need for a trust in the estate planning. And today's laws, especially with the way the estate limitations are, Indiana, they've eliminated the inheritance tax. But there are still some things that you need to do, even if a trust doesn't necessarily fit your particular situation. One specific thing is a simple example. A few years ago, they changed the way that houses can be structured in that you can put a beneficiary on the home. Mm-hmm. And just simply labeling a beneficiary on the home would help eliminate some of the estate hassles for either your executor or your kids, and it avoids that probate process. And those things are going to simplify, and the more you simplify, the less costly they become to the family and the less stressful to the family.
In particular, just one point comes to mind. Say that the husband and wife, getting along in years, they have a child that's still around, maybe because of issues involving health or involving maybe they have developmental problems and the like, but they're still able to do things. You want to take care of them, and that's a good way to be able to at least help keep them in the home if something should happen to you and the spouse.
Absolutely. You know, one we always talk about with, especially if there's a special needs situation, mm-hmm. There's a lot of things to consider with the value, what that can do, especially, you know, if they receive money, a lot of times the current benefits that they're receiving could be discontinued and then those assets until they're used or restructured. And, you know, so there's definitely planning that needs to be done in that area if you have a special needs or there's a control situation is the way words we use often that would definitely benefit the family as opposed to them just receiving those monies.
Now, Greg, we brought up a lot of points here in our conversation. Is there any place that anybody could go to take a look online or get some other information, maybe get ready to go actually sit down with the financial advisor about some of these matters we've talked about?
Yeah, I was, you know, always getting information ahead of time is advantageous. The challenges, as you know, Chris, out there in the media, there's always two spectrums, right? You got one side and the other side, and it's hard because, you know, people are always going to present the way they feel is in the best interest. But just be careful about blanket statements, you know, things that say, hey, always do it this way or always do it that way. I generally think that those are not going to be advantageous in the exploratory stage because you really need to think in the context of your personal situation. And I think just getting a general understanding of some of the things that they're going to be up against before they sit down with somebody, you know, you don't have to know how to fix the car, but, you know, knowing a little bit about how a car operates and the things you got to do are going to be helpful in a conversation with the mechanic, so to speak.
Well,
and that's where I think most people can gain a lot of confidence when they come in and sit down with an advisor.
We've been talking with financial advisor Greg Hammer here in Northwest Indiana about some more matters involving money as this Financial Literacy Month continues. Thank you, Greg, for the updates and the information, and we'll be back with you to check in on other topics real soon.
No problem, Chris. Thanks again.
Once again, we hear about the Society of Innovators in Northwest Indiana putting out another monthly Innovators Award. And this time around, it's once again getting the folks at Edgewater Systems involved. We have an opportunity to find out about the latest project with Edgewater Systems. We have Dr. Danita Johnson-Hughes, who's the president and CEO of Edgewater Systems with us, who helped pick up the big award from the Society of Innovators. And Dr. Hughes, thanks for being with us here on Regionally Speaking.
Thank you, Chris.
Well, first tell us what the Edgewater Systems picked up this award for.
Actually, for some time now, about a year or two, we've been looking at becoming more than just a behavioral health care services provider. We recognize that we have to treat the whole person, that often people present with issues. They may have mental illness, or they may have an addictive disorder, but they also have underlying physical problems.
Mm-hmm.
And to be able to effectively treat someone and put them on the road to wellness, you need to address their other problems. And so we decided we would bring in a totally new arm of what Edgewater Systems has previously done, and that's the primary care arm.
Now tell us how much work was involved in planning and getting all this organized and where the facility is located, because when you're doing what you've been doing for so many years in the facilities that you have, and then you want to branch out and to do something else, you have to spend an awful lot of research time and the like to get ready to be able to do it the way that you want to do it and the way that you know that people who will look to those services will want.
Right. There was a lot of work involved, mm-hmm. to be perfectly honest with you. We met with both organizations met together for, I'd say, probably at least a year and a half as we talked about the potential of partnering with one another and looking at how much alike our missions were and what the differences were. And so we recognized that we had two different cultures. You know, the behavioral health care side is a totally different sort of animal than the primary care side, and they actually operate somewhat differently. And so we had to look at how best to marry the two organizations, and so that took a while. Mm-hmm. But the primary care sites that we were able to acquire out of this process are one in Glen Park, 3939 Broadway, mm-hmm. and the other one in Griffith on Broad Street, just south of Ridge Road. And they provide a lot of different services there, an array of services from, you know, prevention and treatment of, you know, various physical ailments such as diabetes or looking at chronic conditions such as asthma and, you know, those kinds of things, heart disease. They look at those kinds of things, which, you know, have an impact on many of the types of patients we were seeing, you know, in the beginning, you know, and vice versa. They were seeing a lot of patients that they felt probably could use some services as it relates to their mental health. And so we saw a natural marriage there, and so we sort of decided to come together and make it happen.
Well, Dr. Hughes, I know that you have worked with an internist, Dr. Okechi Nabuara. Tell us his role in all this. He was probably pretty instrumental in helping get this all set up, wasn't he?
Absolutely. I've known Dr. Nabuara for a number of years, and actually Dr. Nabuara has practiced in this area for, I believe, well over 30 years. And, excuse me, mm-hmm. He had mentioned, he said many years ago, the fact that he saw the need for persons that he was seeing, patients that he was seeing. Many of them would come in and they would have problems that were kind of beyond the scope of what he practiced, that they needed more in-depth types of treatment as it relates to their mental health, or even people who were addicted to, say, alcohol or drugs. That was kind of beyond his scope. And Dr. Nabuara, I mean, he's a well-respected physician in Northwest Indiana and has, you know, he's on staff at Methodist Hospital and a number of other locations, and he works with nursing homes, and so he has a lot of expertise and experience to help guide us along. And he is the primary physician serving in our primary care locations, and he is the medical director for primary care.
Tell us, do folks come in, they may come in perhaps to see the folks there at Edgewater Systems, and they in turn will get referred to the primary care facility, and then the other way around too, Dr. Mamara and his staff may get to see people at those facilities and say, yes, well, this person needs extra help, and they'll get referred over to Edgewater Systems, won't they?
That is absolutely correct, and in fact, we have put in place a behavioral health care specialist who operates out of the primary care offices. And so a referral is made just right there to that person within the office, and she will do an assessment, determine, you know, if they need services that she can't provide in that office and probably needs to refer to one of our other locations. And so she's right there. And by the same token, we have a primary care happening within our facilities.
Dr. Hughes, since this is being called a rather innovative, integrated model, certainly is involving primary care as well as behavioral health care. Is there anything else that Edgewater Systems is looking at or is thinking about getting involved in that kind of follows through on this innovative path?
Absolutely. The first thing we want to do, though, is refine what we have, because this is a new model, and so it's a work in progress. Mm-hmm. And so we're every day working to make it more effective, more efficient, and so that's our focus right now. We want to really focus on this. And as we become better at it, we recognize that our services are very efficient and cost-effective, then we'll start looking at possibly bringing on additional services, healthcare-related services that fit within our mission. But we don't intend to stop here. We want to continue to grow and develop as a primary player in Northwest Indiana, being available to positively impact community health and well-being.
Dr. Danita Johnson-Hughes is the president and CEO of the Edgewater Systems here in Lake County of Northwest Indiana, and they have picked up an Innovators Award from the Society of Innovators in Northwest Indiana for the latest operation that they have. It's a primary care facility, actually two facilities, in Gary as well as in Griffith, and they picked up the award for the innovative approach that they've taken in dealing with the problems that have not only regular health problems, but behavioral health problems as well, too. Dr. Hughes, thank you very much for being with us. Congratulations to all you folks for picking up this Innovators Award, and we hope to hear some more great innovative things come out of Edgewater Systems in the future.
Wonderful. Thank you so much, Chris.
The Environmental Protection Agency and East Chicago's mayor are at a standstill over the future of a lead-contaminated public housing complex. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Annie Rupik tells us that the EPA maintains it can't move forward with cleanup until it gets more information from the city.
The EPA has different cleanup standards for different land uses, so it always planned to return the contaminated West Calumet housing complex to a residential standard. But it made those plans before Mayor Anthony Copeland ordered the complex torn down. Now the EPA says it doesn't know for sure that the land will be used for housing. It wants a written redevelopment plan from Copeland, but Copeland says he doesn't need to write one because the EPA agreed to use a residential standard in its 2014 consent decree with the companies paying for the cleanup. The EPA says that decree no longer applies to West Calumet. After Copeland held fast to his position in his State of the City speech, the EPA did the same in a statement to Indiana Public Broadcasting. It says it's revising a study of cleanup options for the site, but can't start working without a future use plan. City officials did not immediately respond to a request for comment. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Annie Ropeek.
At the State House, a bill headed to Governor Eric Holcomb's desk would allow governments to charge the public up to $20 an hour for public record searches. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Brandon Smith reports on the House vote on Tuesday to advance the bill.
If a public records request takes more than 2 hours to complete, Republican Representative Kathy Richardson's bill says the government agency can charge up to $20 an hour for the work. Former Governor Mike Pence vetoed such a bill 2 years ago. The Senate made a change to the measure, exempting title records search companies from having to pay the fee. Democratic Representative Matt Pierce takes issue with that change and with the fee in general.
If you're just a concerned citizen and you want some information that's going to take a while, you have to pay. Apparently, if you're like an investigative reporter, you're trying to unroot corruption or something, you have to pay. But if you have an ongoing company that does title searches, you don't have to pay, even if apparently it does result in people having to go and retrieve documents.
The Hoosier State Press Association, which in the past has opposed such bills, supported this year's measure. After a 63-27 vote in the House, the legislation heads to the governor. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Brandon Smith at the State House.
And a bill that requires children under the age of 18 to wear a helmet when riding all-terrain vehicles, ATVs, is now awaiting Governor Holcomb's signature. As Indiana Public Broadcasting's Lindsay Wright tells us, the House voted on amendments made by the Senate on Tuesday.
The Senate amended the bill to make it clear who would be cited by the Department of Natural Resources if a child rides an ATV without a helmet. Bill author Republican Representative Lloyd Arnold applauds the change, but says the real goal of the legislation is to create awareness.
Now at a dealer, if someone goes and buys an ATV and it's for one of their children, the dealer now can say, hey, I want to let you know it's Indiana state law that anybody under the age of 18 needs to wear a helmet. And that's really where we want to take it and get people in the habit of wearing helmets to keep them safe.
An Indiana mom pushed for what's now become known as the Play for Kate bill after her daughter, Kate Bergenschmidt, died in an ATV accident in 2015. Legislators are planning for Governor Eric Holcomb to sign the bill at Kate's Elementary School in Newburgh so her family and friends can be present. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Lindsay Wright.
And that's it for Regionally Speaking. For today, I'm Chris Nolte. Thank you very much for being with us. Tomorrow, we begin our Thursday Reporters Roundtable, talking about the big Northwest Indiana stories of the week. And we hope that you'll join us for that. That's on Regionally Speaking on Thursday.